Hello, and welcome to the Weekly Comic Spotlight on the Comic Book Page podcast. My name is John Mayo.
And I'm Bob Bretall. In this episode, we'll be discussing recently released comics. One from DC, one from Marvel, and at least one other. As always, we'll keep major spoilers to a minimum, but we'll discuss general plot points and storylines of the comics we review.
The comics we'll be talking about in this episode originally came out on October 22nd, 2008, and it was about an average week for me. I got 38 comics, 2 trades, and that was pretty much it.
Well, you're pulling out in front of me as my deep cuts are starting to take effect. I got only 26 comics. I got the Hulk premiere hardcover, The Beast at the Heart of the Atom, with all the Hulk stories when he was kind of subatomic down in Jarella's world.
Right.
I got 3 of those classic Marvel figures, the lead ones, which I'm going to have to talk on our preview show about these figures.
Out. I saw the previews, my God. They're coming out with a million.
With the DC ones, and if I buy all the DC ones and the Marvel ones, I spend like $200 just on these frickin' lead figures. And the DC ones, they're coming out for like a retail price of $14 a piece, more than the Marvel ones cost. And I'm like, I'm on the fence on whether I'm even going to get the DC ones.
Well, I saw the solicits for that, and not only did I notice that they were $2 more for the DC than the Marvel, I figured, ooh, that's not going to go over well with Bob. But it seemed like there were just, like, thousands being released in previews.
You know, the reason that they do that is these are from England, and they've been making them in England for, like, a year already. And now they're just now releasing them in the U.S., so they've got this huge backlog of them. And I don't understand why they do that. I mean, they start them a long time earlier in the U.K., and by the time they get to the U.S., there's a big backlog, so they just solicit boatloads of them all at the same time. They did the same thing when the Marvel ones came out.
Yeah. Well, maybe they just think that market is you know, going to like them better than we might and stuff. So.
Well, I mean, they're from there. I mean, the company's an English company.
Right, right.
Eagle Moss. And, yeah, I got the Death Note Volume 7 DVD anime, which is actually pretty good because it's tracking with the manga really closely. The live-action movie is kind of a modified story, but the anime seems to be tracking, and there's going to be 9 volumes of that all together, so almost done with that. And then I got the 2-pack of AIM agents busts from Bowen.
Cool.
Do want to mention from our forums, got called to task for my statement last week about people buying Secret Invasion in spite of Lentil Yu's art. And it was pointed out that lots of people like Lentil Yu's art. I don't understand why, but I have come to appreciate the fact that a lot of people do in fact like Lentil Yu's art. So I'll retract my statement that people are buying it in spite of Lentil Yu's art and kind of just wonderingly admit that there's probably a lot of people who like his art and they're buying it because of it. I don't get it. But there was a poll that's like a lot of people marked him down as like best in the industry art. And that just tells me I am so out of touch with those people. If that is the best the industry has to offer, I shake my head ruefully. Anyway.
Yeah. Well, it's one of those things that, you know, different things for different people. And that's part of what's so great about the industry and stuff. I remember talking with Lobo from Cryptographics at one point about Simon Dark, and the things he disliked about it were things I liked about it and vice versa. You know, it was one of those things that there was no way that comic could please both of us because we were coming at it from such different angles. Him more from the horror and not wanting it connected to the DCU side, and me more from wanting it connected to the DCU side and not horror, you know?
Yeah. I guess I just had a more insulated worldview before I was doing the podcast and getting exposure to lots of different people, because it used to always be, you know, it's like everybody could pretty much agree on the fact that you know, Alex Ross or George Perez was like good art. And, you know, and at the same time, you know, like there were maybe a couple of people who liked Frank Robbins or something. But, you know, it's like most people are like, yeah, he's okay, but he's not like the best artist that there ever was or anything.
Mm-hmm.
But now you're coming up and it's like you put something like Lentil Yu on Secret Invasion, which is the biggest book at Marvel. And it's like there's a lot of people who are like, ooh, they're loving it. Okay. I can accept it.
Yeah.
Don't agree with it, but I'll accept it.
Well, you know, it's one of those things. I personally am not, you know, head over heels for his art. I find it, you know, again, I'm more of the classic, you know, George Perez, you know, clean, nice art style, stuff like that. And you just isn't doing that style of art, which is fine and good. But, you know, therefore, I'm not going to like it as much as some of these other artists they could have picked. But, you know, I also got to look at the sales figures. And, man, a lot of the stuff he does sells through the roof. So, you know, hey.
Yeah. I mean, I can appreciate different art styles. I mean, I really like Ben Templesmith's art, for instance, which is about as far from, you know, George Perez, Alex Ross style art as you can get. But at the same time, I myself understand that it's an acquired taste and it's not something that I would kind of hold up as, you know, I mean, it's I like it, but it's more like something I would say, I like it, but it's not something I would say, hey, this is the best art that's coming out of the industry.
Yeah.
Maybe somebody would.
But, I mean, that's part of why when we talk about the sales figures, I try to differentiate what I feel about the stuff from how it's selling. Because from a strictly objective point of view, if we were to use sales as the barometer of quality, which is, you know, there's a huge disconnect there, the case could be made that nothing is good because, by and large, everything is going down in sales. So, and clearly that's not the case, because even stuff that's selling near the bottom of the charts, there are a lot of very, you know, vocal fans of these books. You know, in a lot of cases, we're some of those fans. But, you know, it's one of those things. It's funny how kind of what either what we think or what other people think versus how things are selling, you know, just the disconnects that are there.
Yeah. I guess with that point in mind, I mean, given that almost every book drops issue over issue a non-trivial amount, you know, it's like every issue that comes out was, you know, not good enough to keep X number of people coming back for the next one. So, you know, there is something to say about that.
Yeah.
Speaking of issues that are not good enough to have somebody coming back for the next issue, want to talk about this week's books, John?
Well, okay, that's a nice positive upbeat start for that, but sure, we'll go with that.
I'm going to precursor this by saying I read these three books, and we're going to talk about Birds of Prey, Captain America, and Psyblade. Now, Birds of Prey and Captain America are both a couple of my favorite titles coming out, respectively, from DC and Marvel. I normally love them. These issues were not that great. And after I read all three issues, and I'm like kind of, eh, I was like, boy, is there something wrong with me today? Am I just in a bad mood or something? So I went and I read several other comic books in the same sitting after I read those just to, you know, boy, am I just not liking anything tonight today? And, you know, I read the latest She-Hulk number 34 and I liked it. And I read Spider-Man 574, I think it was. I liked that one. And I read the latest Invincible. And I liked that one quite a lot. So it wasn't my mood. There were things that I was liking in the same sitting.
Well,
but, you know, we'll talk about these particular issues.
It's funny you mention that, because I read these on Thursday night. And then we did an interview for the upcoming previews interview thing. I recorded with Chris for the Mayo Report trade section. And then, you know, Friday morning, you know, I was trying to scribble together a couple of notes for the stuff. And I'm like, wow, you know, I've got nothing, you know. So last night, because, again, we record these, you know, Saturday morning. So Friday night, I went through and reread Birds of Prey, Captain America. And before rereading Psyblade, I did something that I should have done before reading Psyblade number one the first time. I read the pilot season issue. Because I hadn't done that before. And on rereading them, these things did, in some cases, a little better, in some cases, not so much. But typically I don't reread the comics a second time before we do the episodes. But after that first one, when I just, it's like, wow, these fell into the just another comic, I've got nothing much to say about them category the first go round. And that's not a sign of bad comics. It's partially a sign of I read a ton of comics and don't have tons to say about every one of them. But shall we go ahead and dive in with Birds of Prey number 123?
Yeah. Now, this issue, I mean, there's a couple of things that kind of – this one – okay, so the team recently is relocated to Platinum Flats, which is the DCU analog for California's Silicon Valley. And as a result, we have lots of DC analogs of real-world companies. You know, we have Feinster, which is essentially Google, and eBay, which is eBay. And, you know, it's like when you're reading a Superman comic, you know, back 10 years ago, and you'd see Big Belly Burger all over the place or soda or cola. And it's just, you know, that kind of stuff takes me out of the story sometimes when I've just got these goofy analogs to real-world things kind of like right there in my face. And I, you know, I don't know why. It's just, it's a personal thing. But that was one thing about this issue. And it just... there's so much of that stuff in it. And then the other thing was, is that issue 122, they were teasing us about the confrontation between the Joker and Barbara Gordon. You know, we ended off last issue with Joker coming to the office where Barbara Gordon was, and he's holding the gun, and Barbara's there, and it's like, ooh, it's Joker, you know, and it's like, okay, you know, something's going to happen here, and there's going to be this confrontation between Barbara Gordon and Joker. They go the entire issue, nothing. And then they set it up with, oh, well, they're really going to have it out next issue again. And it's like, okay, well, this issue was just a filler, and it was almost like a waste of my time to read this issue. That's about it, you know.
Well, going to your point about the fake companies and stuff, I kind of see where you're coming from on that, and you know, I can't fault you for that at all. The part that annoys me with the fake companies is the fact that we're unlikely to ever see them anywhere else ever again in the DC universe. Whereas if they were to run with this and have these be the equivalent of eBay and Google and you know, MySpace and all that kind of stuff, you know,
consistent across the universe.
Oh yeah,
like everywhere in the universe you see Coast City referred to, or Metropolis or something. Yeah, you're right. I mean, it's the same thing. You don't really see it handled like it's part of the manual of, you know, the DC universe, where, you know, people talk about Google all the time in the real world. They talk about eBay all the time in the real world. And if, like, all over all the DC books they're talking about Feinster and eBay, then okay.
Yeah. To me, that would go a long way towards kind of building the DC universe cross-continuity thing in a very subtle way. And build the level of realism, whereas here, you're right, it did kind of detract from it. But, I mean, to me, this whole issue was, it was an okay issue. It was not a good example of Birds of Prey, the series. Because typically this series has some good action moments, good character moments, and good team dynamics and strong women that are what make this title special. But here, I mean, the whole thing, like you said, was teasing, you know, Joker and Oracle meet and stuff. And man, what a letdown. But, I mean, sure enough, that's going to get fixed next issue.
Well, theoretically.
Well, I think it will. But, I mean, you're right. Maybe it won't. I have faith that it will. Let's put it that way. Whether that faith is justified or not, we'll know next issue. But you're right. This issue, nothing happened. Because, I mean, I'm not going to spoil the story. I'm going to leave out a lot of the details, but let me synopsize the story. So the Joker and Oracle face off, meet face to face. He leaves. Oracle has to, as Barbara Gordon, has to deal with the cops. And then talks to the team. The team goes to pick up Calculator, the kind of Oracle's evil counterpart or whatever, who's on the run. Calculator then explains the Silicon Syndicate. The team then arrives back in Platinum Flats, and the Silicon Syndicate members realize they're there. Joker realizes, you know, who Oracle is, and is basically heading back to essentially where that kind of arc left off. It goes in essentially a loop for this issue. And we get kind of the forced cliffhanger of dun-dun-dun, the team's got to face off with the Silicon Flats people. And that's it. I mean, we got like 6, maybe 7 scenes total. All of it's talking heads. When the calculator explains the Silicon Syndicate, he's doing 5 pages of exposition. I mean, some of the characters in here don't even get named. Infinity is used quite a bit, but I don't even think her name shows up anywhere in the issue.
I think they do one time refer to her by name.
Okay, I didn't scan the entire issue looking for it, but it didn't pop out to me. And, I mean, really, this, I would agree, this is a filler issue. This is stuff that almost reeks of the parlor scene in A Mystery Thing, which, if it were explaining stuff we didn't know or really care about or whatever, and in a trade, this probably fits in a lot better. As a single issue, it's not very satisfying. And typically, this series is much better than this. I didn't think it was a horrible issue. I was not, you know, repulsed by it or anything of the sort, but I was very much let down, particularly the Joker-Oracle sequence. Because that whole thing, and again, not knowing how the final issue of the storyline ends, I suspect you could remove this from the context, this entire issue, and have it pretty much flow okay. You know, with the only thing being, okay, oh, the team picked up Calculator. And the rest seems to be, you know, a waste of time and space. And this is going to be a bit of a nitpick, but there was one panel on here that I'm thinking, you got to be kidding me. If you go to the page with this, opposite the Silent Hill ad, which is right after the Navy postcard that sticks out from the damn thing.
Those are really, really irritating me in all the DC comics.
Bugs the crap out of me, too.
Nothing against our fine people in the U.S. Navy, but having these giant, irritating postcards that...
Yes. Well, worth
me unable to flip the pages are pissing me off about the Navy.
Well, worth clarifying. I got nothing against the Navy. My dad was a career Navy guy. It's postcards in comics, regardless of what they're advertising for, that because I can't lay the comic flat and have this page without it flipping up. You know, it's annoying. Anyways. So we got that one page, middle panel, we got Oracle coming into her secret lair on the thing, which apparently you got to have X-ray vision to find, literally. And we see her computer set up. And maybe I just missed this on previous issues, or maybe they haven't shown it to us this way or not. But we see the room, we see the keyboard, the coffee cup, all that kind of a thing on the pedestal, whatever. But it's in this circular area. Have you ever been to a miniature golf course? You know how they have those volcanoes? You got to kind of get the ball up and over?
Mm-hmm.
It's like that. It's like it's got a foot-high speed bump around it in a ring. She's in a wheelchair.
Well, it looks like, from the perspective of it, like directly opposite the keyboard, it looks like it's lower where she could like kind of roll in, you know, directly from the back. But I see your point. It's like, why would you want to put something together so that you're in a wheelchair, you can only approach your computer keyboard from one angle?
Yeah.
It just seems ill-advised, especially since they obviously built this thing from scratch.
So that just annoyed me.
Yeah, that didn't occur to me, but you make a point.
You know, all
I had to go to our definitions of the numbers in order to rate this.
Oh, that's not a good sign. What did you give it?
I gave it a 2. And the reason I gave it a 2 is because, you know, mostly in deference to I generally like Birds of Prey, but, you know, a 3 is good, solid comic, and this was not a good, solid comic. 2 is okay, a few problems with execution, but still worth reading, and that's about where this one was. I mean, if you're a Birds of Prey fan, you know, it was a filler issue, it was okay, but boy, I can't imagine, personal opinion, but I can't imagine someone picking this up as their first issue of Birds of Prey and ever wanted to read an issue of Birds of Prey again.
I go with a 3 on this, and my standpoint is, while it doesn't really advance the story in any serious way and it doesn't showcase the strengths of this book, I didn't think it had any serious flaws. It was just a marking time issue, you know, and it did that in a halfway entertaining way. It didn't have any, oh my God, this is ludicrous type stuff.
Well, to me, sorry to interrupt, but the tease about the Joker and then the cover of this issue says the Joker and Oracle face to face. they're selling this as a confrontation between Joker and Oracle, and the way it was handled in this one was a huge letdown and poor execution in my storytelling-wise.
Well, if you're going from does it meet the cover expectations, technically the calculator does join the Birds of Prey in physical, you know, whether he's not joining the team or anything. And Joker and Oracle are face-to-face, so...
I understand. And I'm not saying anything about, you know, if I'm a lawyer, you know, I can't sue them on it because they met the letter of the law, you know.
Yeah.
Joker and Oracle were indeed face-to-face, but the implication from last issue and the cover here is that there's going to be a little more than them literally looking each other in the face and then walking away.
I agree with that, and I can totally see being let down with that. I was let down with it, too. But, you know, while it failed to meet my expectations, from a technical standpoint, it was a solid comic. I thought it was moderately enjoyable. It was not one that I'm thinking, oh, wow, I'm so glad I read this. Yet also not one I felt, gee, it was a complete waste of my time. It was one that should have...
waste of my time would be a zero.
Fair enough.
So this came up, it was a 2.
Okay.
You know,
and I'm not arguing your rating.
Right. But like I said, that's why I had to go to the definitions, because, okay, a few problems, but still worth reading. And I had a few problems with this one, but I didn't regret having read it. But, you know, it for me, didn't fall into the good, solid comic, because I shouldn't – when something's a good, solid comic, I shouldn't be coming away from it saying – wow, I was really disappointed in that.
And I can see that.
Solid comics should not disappoint me.
Again, it was one of those that, to me, the core problem is it was the fifth chapter in a trade paperback. While it was a little lacking in story content in terms of I wanted to see, I don't know, maybe some good action, maybe some solid characterization, whatnot, it did, again, give us a lot on the Silicon Syndicate. We did have a couple of character moments and a few things here and there. I didn't think it had any major shortcomings other than it being, again, a fifth chapter in a six-issue trade. And if I were to start marking down books on that basis, man, half the – well, you know, four-sixths, you know, two-thirds of the books or whatever would fall into that, you know?
Well,
so.
Interestingly, I think the reason we chose this issue
– oh, totally, yes. Yes, I see.
– was because – we generally like Birds of Prey, and the advertisement was Oracle and Joker face to face, and you're expecting, ooh, this is going to be good, you know, and that's why we picked this issue. And then you open it up and you get what you get.
Yeah. But to me, that's misleading marketing. And I agree also on the cover too, versus, you know, a problem of the storyteller. Now, again, I'm not holding this up as any example of brilliant comics. It is not. It is one that, to me, a 3 is just another comic that I wasn't, you know, thinking, oh, wow, this was worse than average, this was better than average, or anything of the sort. It was an average comic.
Yep. And so. Speaking of average comics, Captain America number 43, part 1 of 3, so we don't have the fifth chapter syndrome.
True. Part of what I liked about this was seeing kind of the World War II era part of the story. You know, it's I like how they're flashing back, you know, with the Bucky's perspective. And I was a little surprised to see the World War II Human Torch there, but I really enjoyed that. I like that character. And seeing, you know, the Steve Rogers Captain America from that time frame also, I think, worked really well. And this was one where, on my first reading, you know, I liked it, but it didn't stand out at me saying, oh, wow, this was brilliant, this was the best issue of Cap, whatever. But part of that is, with this title, Brubaker is telling such a really an epic saga that, you know, it starts back in that first issue, and it goes month to month. It delivers a satisfying issue each and every time. Is any single one of them usually a, oh, wow, this is a life-changing moment? Well, obviously Cap 25 when they kill off Steve Rogers. But beyond that, it's one that I would say is consistently above average, and it's the sum of the parts that are really what makes this title the masterpiece that it is. And, man, I hope this guy, you know, I hope Brubaker stays on this for, you know, at least till issue 50, if not issue 100. If he can keep up this kind of a quality for the long term, we've got another, you know, we already do have another definitive run on Cap, but it's one I want to enjoy for years to come. And like the way he brought in Batroc the Leaper, you know, this is one that the character is a staple of the comic booky comic book Cap. And I don't mean that necessarily in a bad way, but in the bright four-color, you know, acrobatic, you know, superheroic, you know, slugfest kind of a way. He makes Batroc fit into this much more grounded and more realistic version of Captain America. And I was impressed with that. So all in all, I thought this was a really good, solid story with a lot of good character moments, good action, plot progression. It's not something I would say was a oh wow, 5 out of 5 comic, but certainly it was it gets a solid 4 rating for me. You know, this is something that, you know, I enjoy reading each and every month, and this issue was no exception.
I normally like Cap. I liked a lot of the things that you liked about this issue. I liked the flashbacks. There were a couple of things about this issue that I really didn't like. And I mean, it was a good, solid comic. I mean, this is, you know, into my, again, I had to go to the definitions. It was a good, solid comic. It was a 3. Normally, Cap issues are 4s or 5s for me. This one, okay, they bring Batroc in. Batroc has been around for 42 years. Went to Comic DB. He has made over 70 appearances in Marvel comic books since 1966. And now, all of a sudden, he's speaking French. He's French. Cool. But you know what? It really irritates me when writers put the foreign language in and it's not translated for the readers. I am not a fan of the writer saying, ooh, look how, you know, whatever I am, I'm going to put, you know, I'm going to have the foreign character speaking in a foreign language so no one can understand what the hell is going on unless you happen to speak that language. And, you know, putting it in angle brackets and having a footnote saying translated from the French as a, you know, some, or putting a translation or something so that the reader can understand the story that's being told is clear storytelling to me. And when they even make it to the point where in a voiceover commentary box, Bucky is saying, wow, I'm too busy translating Batroc's banter in my head. My French is rusty. And it's like even he's commenting on it. And the fact that he understands the French and is translating it in his head could have been used as a mechanism to translate it for the reader somehow so that I didn't have multiple pages of this issue where I'm not able to understand what Batroc is saying, you know. And then another nitpick, I mean, I know it's rated teen plus, but having Black Widow spend 3 pages in the nude was, to me, not something I want to see in a mainstream Captain America comic book. You don't need to see Black Widow in the nude for 3 pages in Captain America.
No, I see where you're coming from on both of those. Frankly, neither of those issues bothered me. And with Batroc's dialogue, should it have been, you know, translated for us? Yes, I agree with that. Would it have been nice to actually have, you know, thought balloons for the Cap, you know, translating the stuff? That would have been really funny. If it was done, it's like, oh, wait, no, it's this, no, it's that, you know, kind of a thing. And it also would have gone towards that caption. But it kind of goes against current storytelling practices where, you know, they're using captions in place of the dialogue stuff, you know.
Well, other than the fact that the whole issue is narrated with thought captions.
Yeah. You know, so they could have done it in there.
And again, if you're using the Bendis, you know, style where, I mean, he has thought balloons, but you know what I mean? I think they haven't had voiceovers. They haven't had narration or anything like that. If it was like that, then I'm like, okay. But no, they had narration throughout the whole issue.
Yeah, yeah.
And again, 70 appearances from Batroc, and it hasn't been like this before. If it's a new character all of a sudden, fine. But now they're going against how it's like every other time I've seen Batroc, I've been able to understand. you know.
Yeah, and
You know, I can understand. It's like, hey, you know, let's get rid of the outrageous French accent that they use and all this kind of business. I'm fine with that. But, you know, Brubaker is a talented writer. He could have come up with some way of getting this point and this dialogue across to the reader, you know.
Well, and I think the answer is there should have been a couple of more captions in these where we saw Bucky trying to translate. Because, you know, it's like, what's he saying? He's saying this. That would have gotten that across. It would have allowed Batroc to stay doing the French. And us, again, since we're already in Bucky's head following, you know, his voiceover narration, which is clearly happening in real time, it would have fit there and would have made that comment of, hey, I'm too busy translating, make more sense. And, I mean, I completely agree with your points on this. You know, typically this is something that would have really stuck out at me and annoyed the crap out of me, but when I read it, didn't faze me at all, and I honestly can't tell you why. You know, I didn't think anything Batroc was saying was so important that I missed anything by not having it translated.
Yeah, well, you know, which is, you know, story element in and of itself. It's like, okay, I can – this guy's talking for, you know, like 4 pages. And, you know, it doesn't matter what he's saying.
Yeah, oh, come on. In all those other appearances, it never has either. So, I mean, I see your points. I don't disagree with them. For me, they didn't really stick out in my mind. But certainly I would also agree that would be something that would prevent this from being qualified as a perfect comic book also.
Yeah, I mean, it's what knocked it down for me. I mean, normally I like Cap a lot more. This issue, some issues with it. And, you know, this is the same thing with Secret Invasion, where most of the times when you see the Skrulls, you have no idea what they're saying. You know, you've got this weird Skrull lingo coming out of them with, you know, the little symbols and stuff of Skrullian. And, you know, nowhere previously in Marvel Comics has, you know, a Skrull come down and you have not been able to understand a word out of their mouth.
Yeah, yeah. No, I
you know,
completely
and it's
agree
just,
with that.
It gets to a point of if the storyteller's intent is to obfuscate the story, then they're being really successful at that.
But. Yeah. Two things I want to point out about this comic. First off, this does seem to take place after Secret Invasion. Some of the stuff we get early on with Black Widow telling Bucky that, hey, even the heroes are starting to accept you, imply a post-Secret Invasion thing. The other thing I want to point out is if you go to the page with the staple and flip one further back in the comic, on that right-hand page they have the statement of ownership for this issue. This is one of the pieces of data I use to kind of benchmark what percentage of the sales that Diamond accounts for of the overall sales, because this tells both the print run and the paid circulation, and it's a little messy sometimes to do this because you got to figure out, well, which issue are they using for the actual and all that kind of stuff. But if you look at, where is it? Item 15B3, which is about halfway down, it gives the sales through dealers, carriers, street vendors, da-da-da-da-da, and the actual number of copies of a single issue published nearest to the filing date was 87,250. We compare that to the sales through Diamond, or estimated sales through Diamond, for issue 42, which is the September-dated issue, which is what this seems to be referring to. Those were 75,553 issues, and that's about 86.5, a little over 86.6, we'll say, percent of the overall sales. So Diamond seems to be accounting for all but about 14 or 15% of the sales of Cap. So I just wanted to kind of toss that out there as a, hey, isn't that useless trivia information?
And it does actually tell you what the... You got about 3,700 subscription copies.
Yeah, they have both the average and the actual.
Right, but I'm just saying they actually break down how many copies do go out in subscriptions, which would not be in your Diamond numbers.
Correct, correct. They also mention how many are free,
right,
which are comp copies and things like that. It's kind of interesting information to go through. I mean, you know, they're giving away 1,670-ish copies as comps, it looks like. Yeah.
Okay. Cyblade, number one, the agent of cyber data. I call this the Cyblade lays on a table and gurney and then has a protracted, gratuitous shower scene. That's pretty much what happens in this issue, right?
Yeah, pretty much. This was, again, one that I had two different reading experiences for, reading it before and then after the pilot season one. And, man, when I read it before, it was okay. There were bits and pieces that just didn't make sense. Who are some of these characters? What's going on? And, you know, I was interested enough that it's like, okay, I'll come back for another issue, but things didn't really come together in a coherent manner. And once I realized I hadn't read the pilot season one, because I'm like 100 new comics behind and well over 1,000 not new comics behind, probably closer to 2 or 3 by this point, and realized that the pilot season was in there, it's like, okay, I better go reread that before we talk about this. And having reread that, I thought this first issue of Cyblade works much better as a second issue with that pilot season as the first, and that it made just a hell of a lot more sense after that. And I enjoyed it a lot more as kind of part two versus if you're coming in cold or simply don't remember what happened in the pilot season stuff, you really got to read that first.
Yeah, I read the pilot season one, but I don't remember it. It's been long enough, and I didn't go and dig it out of whatever box that I've got it in.
I think it gives so much needed context that they really fail to include here that, yeah, I think that was a major mistake because it was the part of the 2007 pilot season stuff, so it's been at least a year since it came out.
Yeah.
They needed to have a one-page recap with some pictures and stuff like that as to who's who and what's going on and all that stuff.
Yeah, I thought just nothing particularly seemed to happen in the issue with the title character. And as a first issue, I didn't hate it or anything, but it was just kind of there. And nothing about this issue made me have the slightest desire to come back and read number two. And as such, I mean, and I can appreciate it's really number two because the pilot season that came out over a year ago is number one, but as an issue with a giant number one on the cover,
yeah,
they did a really poor job of and you know what? It's not even with an issue number one on the cover because you see how we were just talking about it. Comic sales drop issue over issue all the time regardless. So when any creator is putting out a monthly or periodical comic, whatever the periodicity is, whether it's monthly, bi-monthly, whatever, it is important that in every issue they give the reader a reason to want to come back for the next issue, especially a first issue.
Yeah, well, it used to be the old adage that every issue is somebody's first. I would like to think that's still true, but frankly, I have my doubts. But I would say the updated adage is, you know, every issue may be somebody's first, and every issue is probably somebody's last. You know, respect the first, fear the last. And this should have been a lot more accessible of a story. And I felt that Michael Rochelle, the former handler or whatever, was a more accessible and interesting character in this issue than the title character. And that's not a good sign. And if it wasn't for his part of the story that I found kind of interesting, I agree. I'd be in the same boat of, why would I come back? So they need to give more of a satisfying story chunk, more of a role, which hopefully they'll do in future issues, to the lead character. And, you know, I think by and large, comics need to focus more on every installment needs to be kind of worth the money and justify not only the sale of it, but the sale of the next one. And I can and totally agree with you where this fell short a bit on those marks. And having read just this issue alone, I would have given this a 3 or maybe a 2 with the added context of the pilot season issue. This actually went up to a 3 or a 4 for me because I felt it added to that overall context and was fun, enjoyable, and entertaining. But certainly I think there's room for improvement with this series. It's fun, it's good, but by all means, go hunt down that pilot season issue and read that first. I think that's a necessity.
I gave it a 1.
Wow.
Well,
I'm not faulting you.
I'm just saying it's like, go to the definition. It's like, I read it, and I'm not going to buy issue number 2. So if it got any higher than that, it's like, I should be coming back for number 2, and I'm not.
Yeah, well, and in and of itself, that's a failure of any comic, particularly something with a number 1 on the cover. But any comic where you come out of it thinking, I have no reason to come back, I don't want to come back, something's wrong with that comic. I agree with that.
Now, something else that bothered me about this, go to the page after the page with the staple.
All right, let me flip to
there. This is where I kind of noticed, I mean, something was bothering me as I'm reading through the issue.
Okay.
It was just bugging me at the back of my head. Look at how they're drawing Psyblade on that page where she's standing in the doorway.
Yeah.
There's just something wrong with the proportions of how she's being drawn. The artist, there's, I don't, I can't put my finger on it, but it just seems wrong. You know, it's like I'm reading the issue and something's bothering me about almost every human figure being drawn in the book. And it just seems like there's like a stockiness or something to the characters, or I don't know what, but there's just something
a lot of it is
a little bit off.
Everything else is not quite to the right scale.
Yeah.
Because based on the assumption this is a standard size door, so it's what, 7 feet tall, thereabouts, that would put her at, you know, roughly 6 feet or whatever, but based on where the light switch is, where that, you know, hits on her body, that would put her at much shorter. I mean, it's
That's what I'm saying. It's like, I mean, the light switch, you know, and just, it's not, maybe not the figures, maybe it's just something about the art, it just doesn't seem right.
Well, she feels dwarfish.
There's some consistency issue. Yeah, exactly. There's something wrong, and it's like when I combine the fact that something subliminal is bugging me about the art the whole way through the issue, nothing happens in the issue, and you know all this kind of stuff, and it's just like it all kind of adds up together to be okay. That was an issue. I'm not.
And I can totally see where you're coming from on that. There are a couple of places where the art is really lacking, others where it's a bit better. I felt that quite a bit happened, and again, my first read-through, I didn't care or you know, appreciate what was happening. With the added context, I did. And again, that's a fair complaint against this issue. This should have been something that reasserted the storyline, the characters, and people's interest in that, and gotten us hooked again. And I can see where it failed to do that.
I also thought, and this may be just how I'm coming into it, but again, having her spend 5 pages nude, to me, seemed gratuitous. And it seemed like, well, we're not really telling that good of a story, but let's have her be nude a lot so we'll get people to come back for that. You know, it's just...
That did seem like a cheap sales ploy.
And in fact, one of the covers for this issue is her in the nude in the shower. And it's just, hey, I don't mind naked girls, you know. It's like, but if I want to see naked girls, I'll go look at naked girls. I don't need to see, you know, really feeble attempts at cheesecake in a comic like this. Because, you know, realistically... Little kid, first off, you don't want a little kid reading a book with that kind of stuff. And anyone who should be reading a book with that kind of stuff is old enough to go and see the real article. So what do you need to have it in here for?
Well, I guess part of what I liked about this is I see the potential for this series kind of along the lines of, say, the Alias TV show. You know, you've got the female operative going up against the agency she used to work for and some fun stuff there. But unless this story starts featuring Psyblade versus happening around Psyblade, I may be disappointed. I may end up dropping this. But for now, I'll give it a few issues to see where it goes.
Yeah. Well, like I said, I mean, I was aware as I was reading these that, boy, I'm really feeling bitter about these issues. It's like, hey, let's talk about like any one of the other books that I read last night. And I was really positive about them. So I don't mean to come off as this crotchety old geezer on these issues, but wow, these were so underwhelming as a group compared to the whole rest of the stack of comics that I read last night.
The only thing I'm going to say to that, Bob, is typically when we, with a few exceptions, typically, though, when we differ in our ratings, yours tend to be higher than mine.
Yeah.
And this is definitely against that trend. I see exactly where you're coming from on each of your ratings. I don't fault you for any of them. I'm not thinking, oh, wow, you were too harsh or anything.
It's a good turnaround because now you know how I feel all the other times when...
Well, honestly, I don't think I'm typically all that hard on a comic. I may, you know, point out its negatives where it needs to strengthen, but I'm trying to do that on the off chance any of these creators are or editors are listening to this, trying to give them some constructive criticism. I'm not here to slam any book. I'm just saying what works for me, what doesn't work for me. And there are different readers out there. Different things will work for different people. Take what I say or leave it as they think it's warranted. And for me, comics always start in that center point of that three rating of, well, it's a good average comic. If it was crap, I wouldn't have picked it up to begin with usually. And it's either got to work its way out of that into a four or a five with by impressing me, or down to a two, a one, or possibly even a zero.
I think I could defend how I, you know, look at it the same way. It's just,
oh, I agree.
These things strike me, you know, and it's just, again, you know, go back to, you know, Brubaker, and I have no delusions about Brubaker listening to our show. Just in general, I am not a big fan of that foreign language, you know, kind of thing in comics.
No, and typically I agree with you 100%. Just for some reason that one didn't. I didn't really notice it or you know.
Well, as an example, I read She-Hulk, mm-hmm. right? And at the end of, did you read She-Hulk?
No, not yet. I've got a lot left to read.
Well, foreign language team of characters make an appearance in the book, and if all of a sudden, you know, it's like if every time we saw a character in a Marvel comic that was not native English speaker and they're all speaking, you know, whatever language they speak, wouldn't that sort of start getting on your nerves?
Yeah, and again, typically this is something that bothers me, but I felt in the context of that story, the way the thing flowed, that I didn't feel I was missing something and he was giving away plot points that I just had to have. And you're right, that says something about, you know, the value I place on what Batroc was saying, and not in a good way. So, I mean, typically, yeah, I'd agree with you 100%, but in this case, for whatever reason, and I attribute that to the craft of Brubaker's writing, it didn't take me out of the story, it didn't bother me. But I can totally see where it bothered you and could have and arguably should have bothered me too.
But I will add in Spider-Man 574. Go read that issue.
That's one of the many, many things sitting on my to-read pile.
No, very, very touching issue. I think this will be one that people talk about.
Cool.
Very nicely done. And for people who've dropped Spider-Man or don't read Spider-Man, it actually is a standalone story. It will stand on its own. It has a major change for a long-standing character in the Spider-Man family. And if you have liked Spider-Man and his supporting cast, it's definitely worth having a look at.
Sounds good.
Join us next week when we discuss The War That Time Forgot, number 6 from DC, The Immortal Iron Fist, number 19 from Marvel, and Savage, number 1 from Image Comics.
The show notes and forum for this podcast can be found at www.comicbookpage.com under the podcast and forum sections of the website. Please email us at theguys@comicbookpage.com and let us know what you think of what was discussed in this episode. Thanks for listening.